May I please the court, my name is Stephen Dawes from the law firm of Light, Kelly and Dawes, number 13193, on behalf of the defendant appellant Jonathan Newcomb. The appellant requests that the judgment in this case be set aside and that the case be remanded for a new trial. The reason is that the trial court erred in instructing the jury on the doctrine of aggravation of a pre-existing condition and erred when it didn't instruct the jury on the doctrine related to section 1321.111.5 CRS, the designation of non-party statutes. As you know, this case involves two auto accidents roughly 2 weeks apart in which the plaintiff, Joshua Solomon, sustained injuries. He sustained injuries in the first accident caused by the tortfeasor Kerry Sorn, and he sustained injuries in the second accident caused by my client, Jonathan Newcomb. One of the key facts in this case is that there was medical testimony before the jury, and the testimony was that the TMJ, temporomandibular joint injury, the doctors Lawson and Winber both agreed that 60% of that injury was attributable to the first accident and 40% to the second accident. The neck and back injuries, testimony came from Dr. Floyd Russack, who testified that 50% of the neck and back injuries came from the first accident and 50% from the second accident. There was no testimony from any physician that any injury in the first accident aggravated any injury in the second accident. None. It's not there. In this case, the appellee, Joshua Solomon, in his answer or amended answer brief, states that, the aggravation of pre-existing condition doctrine applies because there was an aggravation of pre-existing condition. Not true. There was no testimony of that effect. What the doctors did was they said, here's the injury, for the neck and back, 50% each, for the TMJ, 60-40. The trial court, at the close of the plaintiff's case, I moved for directed verdict on the non-party designation because you'll recall that plaintiff had sued both Kerry Sorn from the first accident and my client from the second accident. Kerry Sorn had settled with the plaintiff. On the day that came out, I designated Ms. Sorn as a non-party at fault. So at the close of the plaintiff's case in the trial, I moved for directed verdict on the non-party at fault designation.
I realize these cases were brought together, but in your case, you're the second driver.
Correct.
The first driver is not even a part of your case.
Yes, the first driver was until they settled, then became a non-party.
Well, but you made him a non-party contributor.
Right.
Doesn't that envision one accident in which there are more than one tortfeasors, rather than two accidents with separate tortfeasors, each of whom is 100% liable?
No. The reason is that under the A.G. Edwards versus Moody case, the tortious conduct does not have to occur simultaneously in both instances. You can designate as a non-party at fault someone who contributed to the accident in other unrelated tortious conduct as long as it contributed to the injuries being claimed.
Mr. Dawes, let me ask you about that case. In that case, wasn't there a single injury and there was negligence of one party and misappropriation by another party and they each had a role in contributing to that single injury?
That's correct.
All right, so how...
The conduct was separate.
It was separate,
conduct separate times.
Leading to
one
the single injury, the single incident.
Right.
Okay, is this case not different because we have two completely unrelated accidents happening on different dates?
Nope.
And why is that?
You don't have to have the same series of events. You can have an injury caused by a breach of fiduciary duty and an injury caused by a breach of contract by two different parties as long as they contribute to the same injury. And if you look at the
front... But are we contributing to the same injury? Because at the time of the second accident, your accident, the plaintiff had been injured in the first accident. It's a separate injury. It's an injury to the same parts of his body or, you know, whatever. But that sounds more like aggravation than multiple tortfeasors causing the same injury.
But that's not what the testimony was. The testimony wasn't that the second accident aggravated any injuries. The testimony was that, take the TMJ injury, one injury, 40% caused by my accident, 60% caused by the first accident. That was the evidence. Wouldn't be any different, for example, if I may interrupt.
Sure.
Wouldn't be any different if Carrie Soren had not settled. If she had not settled and was there at the trial, what would have happened? Jury would have been instructed, okay, how much damages was caused by Soren and how much damages was caused by my client? Well, the fact that Soren settled out allows me to designate her as a non-party and ask the jury the same question. Jury didn't get that chance. The judge took that away from me at the close of the plaintiff's case.
Let me ask you this question. Was Soren liable for the second accident?
No.
So how could Soren, explain to me then how Soren could then be proportionally liable for that second accident under the statute?
Look at Fried versus Leong. That was a case I'm intimately familiar with because I represented an excess insurer of Corky Long. Corky Long was a psychologist who treated Dawn Fried, and in the malpractice as a result of having an affair with her, the malpractice lawsuit, the defense side designated a host of people, including two different series of people who had raped this woman, the parents who had abused her and abandoned her, the brother who had abused her. What happened in the Court of Appeals decision is that they said, look, you can designate those whose conduct contributed to the injury, even if the conduct is separate and distinct in time from the conduct of Corky Long. What you can't designate is those whose conduct didn't contribute to the injury. So in that case, the end result was that Corky Long's malpractice of Dawn Fried was allowed to go to a second trial. I think they settled, but it went to a second trial, and they were allowed to designate those individuals whose conduct concurrently contributed to injury. It wasn't the same conduct, it wasn't malpractice. It was the two people who had raped her and assaulted her in the hospital, and that conduct had occurred at the same time as Corky Long was treating her. What they couldn't designate were the parents whose conduct that was tortious was remote in time. So it's the same thing we have here. We have the first accident, injuries, before any treatment occurs, another accident, and injuries. And the doctor said, okay, take the neck and back. 50% of that injury was caused by the first accident, 50% by the second accident. They didn't say the second accident aggravated the injuries in the first accident. That's why it's appropriate for non-party designation. You don't have to have two people running into one car at the same time. What you have to have is tortious conduct resulting in injury concurrent with the injury caused by the first incident. I hope that answers your question.
That is the water, but it answers the question.
That's funny. I think it's crystal clear. But from my perspective, the other problem here is that this aggravation of a pre-existing accident theory proposed by the judge was contrary to the position the parties had taken. We all went into the case agreeing that this was a proper party, a case of non-party designation. The doctrine of aggravation of pre-existing condition was never pled in a complaint, amended complaint, wasn't in the trial management order, was in nothing. I had no notice of that theory until the close of the plaintiff's case when the judge, in my motion for directed verdict, raised that issue. We never had the opportunity to rebut that theory, and I don't think the court can make up a theory and propose it to the jury in the absence of some consent by the parties or trying a case where the facts are such that the pleadings could be amended to accommodate those facts. It's like if I had defended a case where somebody brought an assault claim, an intentional assault claim, and at the end of the evidence, the judge said, well, you know what, I'm going to allow a negligence claim. That's not appropriate. I agree with the concept that the court can is obligated to instruct the jury on the law as it applies to the facts of the case, but I don't believe that the court can add a new theory without notice to the defendant an opportunity to defend that.
Didn't the jury, in fact, allocate between the two accidents?
Well, what they decided was that for the non-economic damages, they said, this is based upon instruction created by the trial court in this case. It was not a pattern instruction. The trial court sat down and typed this one out while we Mr. Lapham and I were waiting for the instructions to be finalized. And he allowed them to have a line that said total combined damages for non-economic damages. And how much is apportioned to the first accident, how much is the second accident, and how much, if you can't decide, how much you can't you decide on. And he did that for combined non-economic, economic, and physical impairment. So what happened was on non-economic, they found $15,000 between both accidents. and apportioned $2,250 to my client. On the economic damages, they found $26,335, which was essentially the medical bills, and they apportioned $4,685 to the first accident and $825 to my accident. So that means that they found my client caused $3,000 in damages. But because they couldn't apportion $20,000 of the economic damages, after the verdict, the trial court amended the issued a judgment finding me my client responsible for that extra $20,000. So that's why we think it was an error. I'd like to reserve my remaining time. Thank you.
Thank you. May it please the court. My name is Joe Lapham, and I represent the plaintiff appellee in this case. I'm going to jump straight to the non-party statute and why it doesn't apply to this case and why the judge in this case correctly ruled that it didn't apply to this case. The non-party statute, or the pro rata liability statute, apportions fault for negligence or fault. It doesn't apportion damage.
Let me ask you at the outset, were you involved in the trial?
In some capacity, I was, Your Honor.
Well, I understand the parties stipulated to that.
My understanding of what happened at the trial was that the parties proposed jury instructions like we do in every case, and in those jury instructions were the non-party instructions. So when you give your instruction to the court in the trial court, you give them a kind of stipulated version and an objected to version. In the stipulated version was the non-party.
And both parties submitted instructions on that.
Both parties agreed to those instructions. That's correct, Your Honor. What happened later on in the trial, the judge asked us about that and said, you know, based on the evidence, we don't think that, I don't think this applies. I think the aggravation of pre-existing life.
Where is later on in the trial? At the instruction conference or somewhere during the evidence?
I can't remember off the top of my head. It was either... right, it was near the end, I can tell you that. So there might have been one more witness.
It was after all the experts had testified and
most of the experts, I would assume, would have testified by then, because I think that the plaintiff went on last. So it might have been before the plaintiff went on, or it might have been after, but the judge alerted to us the day before about the issue, said go look at it, and then we came back and did closing arguments and looked at it there. Looking at the non-party statute, the reason it doesn't apply in this case, although at the beginning we may have thought it did, we were in error, and I don't think it applies, and the judge, I think, was correct in that. The reason it doesn't apply is that it apportions fault or negligence, it doesn't apportion damages. And the plain language of it says that it apportions, and Judge Lichtenstein pointed to that, it apportions pro rata liability if you cause one injury, versus if you have two separate events causing two separate injuries. The pro rata statute doesn't apply to those successive tortfeasor cases. One of the cases that was talked about earlier was the Moody case. And I submit that the Moody case is a concurrent liability case where there was one injury caused by two separate acts. Now, the acts happened different in time, and counsel's correct on that. But nonetheless, the reason it was concurrent is because it needed both of those acts to have an injury. And if you separate it out, in that case, we have a plaintiff entered into a contract to sell to the Hendersons, they were referred to. The plaintiff, pursuant to that, to sell the house to the Hendersons, lent the Hendersons money for the sale. The Hendersons gave a promissory note that was secured by the defendant. Now, the defendant was to give this money, basically, to the bank to hold while everything went through. Unfortunately, the defendant in that case did not. They gave it directly to the Hendersons. The Hendersons spent the money, so they misappropriated the funds. And so you had two torts, basically. You had the negligence and the breach of contract from the defendant in giving the money, and then you also had the misappropriation from the Hendersons. So what happened in that case is the defendant non-partied the Hendersons, and I think so correctly. And the way I broke this down, I think, to make it clear on concurrent versus successive, is if you take the two torts, we have the tort of negligently giving the money, and we have the tort of misappropriation. If either of those is missing, there's no injury. Okay, so the injury in that case is the loss of the security. So, for instance, if you take away the defendant's conduct in that case by giving the money to the Hendersons, there's no injury. If you take away the misappropriation of the funds, so you say that the defendant gave the funds to the Hendersons, but they didn't misappropriate, there's no injury. So that's what we have there is concurrent tortfeasors causing one loss, and that's why pro rata applies. Because before we used to have joint and several liability, and the pro rata statute was to erase that. This case is different in the sense that you have two crashes. You have the first crash where the plaintiff is injured. The plaintiff injures his head, his neck, his jaw, his back. The second crash, 21 days later, a separate event, different times, different places, different impacts, you have further injury. You don't have a head injury, but you have aggravation of his injury to his neck and his back and his jaw. The reason the non-party statute doesn't apply to that is if you take either crash away, you still have injury. So if you take the second crash away, it's all from the first crash. There's still injury from there. You take the second crash away.
Let me ask you two questions. Assuming you're correct, shouldn't plaintiff have an opportunity to try the case under the law that it was decided under?
Well, in fact, the both parties tried it under these facts.
I know that, but I see, that to me, it might affect the doctor's testimony and the way they present the evidence and permit the jury to make an allocation along the lines that they were instructed to do. And then my second question is, what is the basis for the judge ignoring the allocation of the injuries assessed by the jury and making Mr. Newcomb pay the $21,000 they couldn't apportion?
Okay. I'm going to address the second one first.
That's fine.
And that is just a doctrine of aggravation of a pre-existing injury. It's based on Newberry v. Vogel, and it's kind of been referred to throughout the country as a Newberry rule. And what it says is if you have separate torts like we have here, and we have one injury occurring in time, and then we have another injury occurring in time that, and the first injury hasn't, you know, gone to completion, and it's you know, there's still some lingering symptoms, then what it says is both parties have to pay for what they did. So the first injury would have to pay up until the second injury, because they shouldn't have to, the first accident shouldn't have to pay for anything that happened after the second accident and an aggravation. And what the law basically says is we're going to have to apportion that somewhere. And what we're going to do is we're going to give the jury an opportunity to apportion the damages between the two. However, it's also true that sometimes you just can't do that. And if a jury, so when the jury answers a question, they say they can't apportion, we're going to give it to the second accident. So that's the whole doctrine of aggravation of pre-existing conditions that's been illuminated.
Let's go back to the first question.
Can you repeat the first question?
The first question is, if we're going to handle the apportionment of the damages this way, should not the plaintiff have an opportunity to try the case under the law that's being applied to it?
Yes, and I submit that we actually did that in this case, because there wasn't any surprises. This case wouldn't be tried any differently than it would today than it would back when it happened, because the defendant's whole argument in this case was that some of these injuries may have been related to the first accident because of the way that accident happened, and some of these injuries may be related to mine. But what I'm going to do is I'm going to talk about how this first accident occurred, you know, what the forces were, what happened to the plaintiff while he was in the seat. All of the same evidence that was already presented would be the same evidence that would apply, regardless of which doctrine you're going to call it under. I would submit that the defendant would do the exact same thing. I also want to point
out the expert testimony.
The expert testimony, the doctors apportioned injuries between the accidents. All they did was, the testimony all said was, we apportion this amount to this accident and this amount to this accident. In reality, what they were doing was apportioning, okay, the initial injury here, and then we have the aggravation of the injury. I mean, that's if you look at the facts, regardless of the words, that's what happened. Did they use the actual word pre-existing? Did they use the actual word aggravation? No. But I'd like to point the court to that, to Lawson v. Safeway case. And I believe that case is directly on point. In that case, the plaintiff fell on spilled milk at Safeway. During the trial, the defendant raised issues of the plaintiff's prior accidents, prior slip and falls, the same type of evidence, you know, another act prior. The plaintiff in that case did not present any evidence of pre-existing injury, didn't say aggravated, they didn't do anything like that. So the court, the whole issue in that case was whether the court erred in giving instructions on damages for aggravation of pre-existing condition when plaintiff not present the evidence of those things. And the court said that there was no error in giving the instruction. The court's supposed to do, was supposed to look at the facts of the case and apply the appropriate law. So I would say it's res judicata based on Lawson v. Safeway about what happened here, because it was the same thing. We both parties talked about both accidents. There wasn't anything that was a surprise.
Mr. Lapham, let me ask you about that Lawson case. So my understanding is there was no testimony as to pre-existing condition or aggravation thereof, but there was just evidence introduced of a prior accident and that injuries may have been resulting from the prior accident as opposed to the current one that was on trial. So in that case, the court determined it was not error to have a pre-existing aggravation instruction. So then my question based on that is, do you need consent of the parties to go on that theory, as Mr. Dawes has suggested? Once evidence is introduced by a party of a prior accident, do you then need consent to go on that theory?
I think based on that case, it shows that you don't have to. Because the outcome of the case was there was no mention of it, and they went forward with it, and then the defendant later came back and said, well, they never mentioned anything of it. So I'm assuming the defendant didn't agree to the instruction, although it's not in the case. I would submit, though, that the judge is in charge of giving the law. I mean, the parties give proposed instructions on what we think, but the judge ultimately makes that decision based on what the judge has heard. I mean, I wish pre-existing would have been said and aggravation would have been said in the trial, but it wasn't. But the fact of the matter is the defendant wasn't prejudiced at all by that because it was, again, the same evidence. A couple of other things I'm going to point out. A good case to look at is Romero v. Parker. That was another case where the doctrine of aggravation of pre-existing injuries was applied, the doctrine of apportionment. In that case, you had two crashes 68 days apart. The jury stated that both defendants were negligent, such same as this case. Jury stated that both defendants' negligence caused injury. Again, if you look at the verdict form, it was the same in this case. And the jury stated they couldn't apportion those injuries. So what had happened is the defendant was responsible for the entire verdict, appealed, and the court again reaffirmed basically Newberry. So unless there are any other questions, I'd like to just close and say that the judge in this case applied the appropriate law. Any overturning of that would be under the abuse of discretion, and that cannot happen unless there was substantial prejudicial error, which I submit based on the evidence that there wasn't. Thank you.
On the issue raised by someone as to whether or not the plaintiff conceded, I would direct the court to the transcript of Wednesday, October 21st, 2009, page 76. The plaintiff rested at lines 1 through 3. I raise a directed verdict motion. Counsel for plaintiff who works with Mr. Lapham is Rebecca Albano, said, Your Honor, plaintiff does not dispute the non-party designation. Plaintiff has let counsel know that a couple of times prior. Plaintiff does not dispute that there should be a line on the verdict form for this accident. Therefore, I don't think that there's anything in dispute with regard to that. That answers the question raised by someone as to whether or not there was agreement by the plaintiff as to the non-party designation. Second,
when were you advised of the court's inclination, if you remember, to go on a different theory?
At that point, because the plaintiff had rested their case, all the doctors had testified, because I didn't call any independently. I moved for directed verdict on the non-party designation, and the judge started raising that issue at that point. He didn't decide anything, waited until we had our instruction conference. I made an argument off the record, and then He indicated where he was going, and then at the formal reading of the instructions, I made my objection. I tendered non-party designations statutes. I made my record at that point, but it got raised at the end of the plaintiff's case.
Was there any request to reopen the evidence based on the court's ruling?
No, I did not. And once again,
would the testimony have been different?
Yeah, I think the testimony would have been the same by the doctors, and that was just about what I was about to say, is that on the neck and back injuries, 50% was caused by the first accident and 50% caused by the second accident. On the TMJ injuries, 60% and 40%. I don't think it would have been any different. There was no testimony of any aggravation. It is a straw man that the plaintiff is, the appellee is raising here. There was never any suggestion by the doctors of any aggravation. There was no testimony about that. There was no evidence about that.
How would this case be distinguishable from Lawson versus Safeway?
Because in the Lawson case, there was no non-party designation. We don't know whether or not there would have been or what would have happened had there been a non-party designation. And in the Romero case, that case was decided, before the non-party statute was enacted. That case is from 1980. In fact, the trial court in this case, as authority for his position, cited all cases that preceded the adoption of the non-party designation statute and a case from Hawaii Montalvo versus Lapez that had nothing to do with non-party designation. These are all cases that didn't consider that doctrine. If the plaintiff had intended to present a case of aggravation of pre-existing condition, then they could have called witnesses to say that, and they didn't. If the plaintiff had intended to have an aggravation of pre-existing condition, they could have pled it in a complaint, amended complaint, trial management order, or tendered instructions, and they did not.
Mr. Dess, I do have a question about that. Once a party introduces evidence that can support a different theory, does that party also have to consent to that other theory being injected into the instructions as it was in this case?
Yes.
And what authority do you have for that?
I think that, can't tell you the case off the top of my head, but I think that the theories can be modified, or the amended complaint can be modified, or the legal theories can be modified if tried with the consent of the parties.
Which means without objection, doesn't it?
Yes. And I can tell you, I definitely objected to the aggravation of a pre-existing condition theory.
But you didn't object to the evidence apparently that supported it. These things get amended at the end of the trial because the evidence necessary comes in during the trial without objection.
There was no evidence that supported it.
No evidence of aggravation.
Correct. None. If somebody says, you caused half that injury and you caused half that injury, that's not aggravation. That's you each contributed 50% of the injury. That's what the evidence was. Please don't be fooled into thinking there was evidence of aggravation. There was not. None. The doctors testified 50-50 on the neck and back, 65.
How would they testify differently if it were aggravation?
Well, somebody would have to come in and change their testimony. They'd have to say, I think that, Joshua Solomon had a TMJ injury in the first accident and you aggravated it to some degree. They didn't say that. They just said each contributed a percent of that injury.
Total injury.
Yes. That's not aggravation. I'm out of time. Thank you.
All right. It's our time.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We thank both counsel for your arguments and briefs. The case will be deemed submitted and a written opinion will issue in due course.